You're listening to the free edition of Sweden in Focus from The Local. If you would like to listen to a full-length version of the podcast, as well as an additional midweek episode, please check the episode notes for details on how to upgrade to Membership Plus. Here's this week's free edition.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Hello and welcome to Sweden in Focus, The Local's weekly news podcast. We are recording this episode on Thursday, the 21st of September. And this week, we're going to give you advice on how and where to forage for mushrooms. We'll talk about how Sweden's tallest mountain is continuing to melt. We'll discuss Sweden's new budget and how it will affect listeners. And finally, we'll go in depth on a recent deadly escalation of hostilities in Sweden's ongoing gang crime epidemic. I'm Paul O'Mahony, and sitting with me today in Stockholm is the Swedish crime reporter Katrin Krantz, and we're joined from Malmö by The Local's Emma Lovegren and Richard Orange. Welcome to the podcast, Katrin.
Thank you.
We're going to be talking to you quite a bit later on about gang violence. But to start with, can you please tell listeners a little bit about yourself?
Yes, I've been working as a crime reporter and a news feature reporter for about 20 years, mainly at Expressen, which is a newspaper that has always been very strong on covering crime. But I have to say that these last few weeks have been exceptional, though, even for us.
Yeah. Okay, and we'll hear much more about that later on. Thanks very much for that, Katrin. And please feel free to jump in on any of the topics we're about to discuss, starting with mushrooms. Richard, you're a frequent forager and our in-house fungus expert, I think we could say. It's been a good year for mushrooms, hasn't it?
I'm more an enthusiast than an expert, which with mushrooms is a bit dangerous, actually. but they say it's a good year, and it certainly started really early, at least a month earlier than normal. And the Svamp Club Facebook page, which is huge, it has like 100,000 members. Svamp Club means, I don't know what it means, mushroom present? I don't know. It's full of people showing off, you know, these huge tables covered in chanterelles. And so it's definitely good for most people. But I have to say, my own mushroom picking places haven't been very productive. I'm not sure why that is. So I'm on the lookout for new ones.
And what are your best tips for anyone who wants to head into the woods and start picking?
I think the best advice for a beginner is to just learn one or two mushrooms really well and go out only looking for those. Because when I started, I'd go out with a basket and just pick pretty much everything and then try and work out what it was, which is completely pointless and also a bit dangerous because you might have something where, you know, even a small amount can do you some damage. So, you know, down here in the south of Skåne, you know, the seps or beleats, you know, the porcini mushrooms that the Italians eat are quite probably the most common and a good one to start with. And further north in most of Sweden, maybe just learn chanterelles, which are these kind of yellow mushrooms. Yeah. And the good thing about those is that they're both quite easy to identify and nothing you can confuse them with is likely to kill you. So, you know, I mean, even if you pick the wrong type, that, you know, the false chanterelles, they just taste bad. They don't do you any damage. And another piece of advice is if you possibly can, you should get a friend to show you a good spot, because it takes years to find somewhere that's decent. It took us years anyway to find places that actually produce mushrooms. But it would have to be a very good friend, because Swedes famously don't share their mushroom picking spots with anyone, even their closest friends. But amazingly, actually, somebody on this Facebook page shared their spot in Northwest Skåne. I think they were moving house or something.
Right.
So me and 100,000 other people will be going to Klippan to try and see if they can find any chanterelles. And just generally, if you're looking for a spot, what you want is I think, older pine or fir trees, ideally mixed with birch, I think. You know, it seems to work best where there's a little bit of a mixture of different types of tree and an older tree. So it kind of doesn't really matter if it's a plantation, but you don't want the ones that have been planted in the last like 20, 30 years. You need to be sort of 50 years or 60 years or something to, I don't know why that is, but it does seem to be the way. A general good rule is to avoid any white mushroom with white gills and any little brown mushrooms with brown gills. They're the most poisonous.
Okay, and have you
this
ever...
It's a general rule, and there are white mushrooms with white gills you can eat, and little brown mushrooms with brown gills you can eat, but it's just, if you're starting out, it's just not worth the risk.
And have you ever poisoned yourself? It sounded like you were taking some risks in the early days.
No, I haven't.
Good.
Or maybe I may have eaten. There's a mushroom called, in English, it's called the yellow stainer, which looks a bit, the English mushrooms have the best names, I have to say, but the yellow stainer is kind of, it looks a bit like a field mushroom, you know, those, you know, big white field mushrooms you can get in. But the difference is if you cut it, it goes yellow quite quickly. And I think I ate a few of those ones, but they don't do you much damage. They just make you feel a bit ill.
Richard came into the office the other day and was terrified that he had poisoned himself from making a poisonous mushroom soup.
I I think that's more because I'm neurotic than that I'm dangerous. Every time I eat mushrooms, every time I make a mushroom soup, I'm always like, oh, was one of those toadstool? No, maybe I shouldn't have picked that pink brittle gill. I don't know. Yeah, but I haven't actually done myself in.
Good. How about you, Emma? Are you a mushroom enthusiast?
I don't have the same gung-ho attitude to mushrooms as Richard does, or to anything in life, actually. But no, I just pick chanterelles because those are the easy ones. And I don't even pick those, to be fair, because I can't find them. It's hard to find the spot.
How about you, Katrine? You a regular mushroom picker?
No, I want to be. I have an intention to every year. But I also, like, I don't have a good spot and I always end up being where everyone else is. And yeah. Unfortunately, I haven't picked many mushrooms in my life. I had a colleague who came to the office with 30 kilos of chanterelles.
30 kilos? Yes.
Yeah, a bit of envy there, but no.
That's crazy. What's the street value of 30 kilos of chanterelles?
That's like 10,000 kroner. I said I was going to geotagga. What was it called in English?
Geotag, yeah.
Geotag his car, but he didn't.
Do it. Put some sort of tracking device on there.
Yeah.
No, don't do it.
Can't believe the gangs fight over drugs and not chanterelles.
Exactly. Thanks, everybody. We'll put a link to Richard's mushroom foraging guide in the episode notes. We're going to get out of the woods and into the mountains now, more specifically to Kebnekaise, Sweden's highest mountain, which is located in the Scandinavian mountain range in the far northwest of the country. It was in the news recently because an annual review of its height showed that one of its peaks is continuing to shrink. Emma, can you give us the lowdown on this? Why is part of the mountain melting and how does it affect people who want to climb to the top of Sweden's highest peak?
Okay, so Kebnekaise basically has two main peaks. So there's the southern one and the northern one. And the northern one is just rocks, so its height just stays the same. But the southern one is covered by a glacier, so it kind of varies in height depending on how much it snows. So it actually varies like throughout the year. It's at its highest point in May after the winter and lowest in September after the summer. But it's also shrinking just in general because of climate change. Because it just doesn't snow as much in winter as it used to, and the snow melts faster. In the last 25 years, it's lost about 1 meter a year. So it's now 2,093.2 meters, which is 1.4 meters lower than this time last year. Interestingly, the southern peak actually used to be the tallest peak, but in 2019, it was overtaken by the northern peak, which is 2,096.8 meters, which is the same as it has been for hundreds of years. And other than this obviously being a pretty worrying sign of climate change, it's also sad for hikers, because the thing about the southern peak is that anyone can climb it, as long as you're like reasonably fit and you make sure that you prepare and stuff like that. But to reach the northern peak, you should really be a pretty seasoned mountain climber and you should bring proper gear and a guide. And like, I used to go hiking in Scotland a lot, but I wouldn't be able to climb the northern peak. So I've lost my chance to climb Sweden's tallest mountain.
Katrine, have you ever been to Kebnekaise?
Oh, no. It's a bit like with the mushrooms. Yes, I would love to go. I have an intention to, but No, I haven't. I end up driving my kids to the mall or something.
So, yeah, yeah.
But yes, it's very beautiful from what I've seen. So you should go, I guess, before it's too late.
Yeah. How about you, Richard?
No, I was actually planning to climb it in the summer with a friend from the UK, but the flights were just too pricey for him, so we just abandoned it. But luckily, it would have been, it's quite luckily actually, because that the week that we were planning on climbing it is the same week that everybody at the kind of Vanderhem, just before you climb, came down with this terrible vomiting bug. So there were like thousands of climbers just kind of having to go home because they were sick everywhere.
Okay, yeah.
So I dodged the bullet. I would have spent all the money and not been able to climb it probably. So it's quite good.
Yeah, I haven't climbed it either. Maybe we should have some sort of a team building exercise where we go to Kebnekaise.
Yeah, I'm up for that.
Nobody jumped on that idea very quickly. Okay, thank you for filling us in on Sweden's highest mountain. We're going to link in the notes to a very entertaining and informative article that our former colleague Oliver G wrote about his trip to Kebnekaise and all the mosquitoes he met along the way. Well worth a read if you have the time. We published a survey a few days ago about podcasts that many of you have already responded to. If you haven't, we'd be delighted if you could take a moment to answer the questions. It takes very little time, but it's helping us a lot as we plan for the months ahead. And a big thank you to everyone who has answered the open-ended question at the end of the survey. You said so many nice things that have given us enough energy and inspiration to take us all the way through the autumn and winter. And we will add a link to the survey in the notes, so please check it out if you can. Okay, the budget now. So the Swedish government presented its new budget this week, and there were lots of nuggets in there that will affect listeners in various ways. Let's have a look now at some of the key points. First of all, Richard, what would you say are the elements of the budget that have generated the most debate?
I'd say two things. One is the decision to pause this automatic raising of the threshold for paying state income tax, which sounds very technical, but is actually bringing in the biggest chunk of new money into the budget. It's going to bring them 12 billion krona extra to spend. So it's actually the biggest single new number in the budget. And the second is the impact on emissions, on Sweden's plans to reduce emissions of tax cuts to petrol and diesel, but also changes to this biofuels obligation.
Yeah.
And both of those things, the tax cuts to diesel and the pausing of the raising of the threshold for state income tax, were announced 2 weeks ago. So they're not exactly new, but they're still the bits that have generated by far the most debate in the papers. Just to quickly go through them, the first one, the lowest salary that you can have without having to pay state income tax, because in Sweden, most of your tax goes to the municipalities and the regions, and you only start paying state income tax when you have a certain amount, and that the salary would have gone from 51,000 krona a month to 57 krona a month, and it will now stay at 51,000 krona, so it won't be adjusted up to inflation. And this came as a huge shock to moderate supporters, and particularly to Timbro, which is Sweden's right-wing think tank, because it's something the Social Democrats have been calling for, because they were sort of presenting it as an automatic, as a tax cut for the well-off. And the government obviously decided they didn't want to be seen bringing in a massive tax cut for the well-off, and actually would quite like to have that 12 billion krona as well. And so they didn't do it. So what you've had is you've had Timbro saying, you know, no, it doesn't matter who you vote for, you still get a Social Democrat finance minister, which is quite a harsh thing to say. And also, I've seen a lot of political commentators like Thomas Ramberg, who's writing in Dagens Nyheter, saying that this failure to sort of cut tax for most people could cost the moderates the next election, because he says, you know, government can't survive if it doesn't improve the situation for its core voters. And if you compare to people, remember Anders Borg and the finance minister under the Alliance government, who cut taxes all over the place and reduced the tax burden for the rich, but also ordinary people quite significantly. And this government, partly because it has to spend so much on defense and partly because it wants to keep inflation under control, isn't doing that. And people who want tax cuts, like the right wing economic liberals, are upset about that. And there's been a lot of debate about that in the papers. And the other thing on the environment, the reason that that caused a furore was not exactly so much the cut on the tax on petrol and diesel, which were 75 euro for petrol and 43 euro a litre for diesel. It's more the impact that it is having on the government's green goals and Sweden's emissions. And that is the angle that the international press focused on. So the Guardian newspaper wrote about how Sweden was increasing its emissions, and the AFP Newswire did. And even Expressen, the newspaper, your newspaper, Katrine Richard, which is generally to the right, it was kind of the main point in their leader. They said, you know, the environment is, they called it Den store plumpen in the budget, which I think means kind of like a big ugly ink stain. I'm not sure. What does it mean? Swedes.
Help yeah, me. I think that's kind of what it means.
Yeah.
Like, I even saw actually the former moderate mayor of Stockholm, she criticized the impact on emissions in a post on LinkedIn. So it's like some of, like this debate is not just kind of being pushed by the left.
I think, you know, a lot of people don't like the idea of Sweden rolling back its environmental ambitions.
Yes, well, Sweden basically abandoning the kind of leadership on green issues.
And the reason that that got, I think, so much attention is just the nature of budgets. But in the budget statement, they have to account for the effect that all of the policies will have on emissions, which means that, you know, there's a table that basically just says emissions are going to increase by between 5.9 and 10 billion tons up to 2030, which is colossal. And as a result, it says Sweden will miss pretty much all of its national and international climate goals. Mm. And just the fact that is there in black and white in the budget document has, I think, created a lot of debate, and people have been tweeting out, you know, some of the more hair-raising figures. And so I'd say those are the two big ones. And the other thing that's got a bit of comment is that they've provided 10 billion in extra funding to municipalities in the regions, which municipalities have been screaming for because inflation has pushed up their costs so much and they're having to cut back on schools and healthcare. It's the biggest new spending element in the whole budget. It dwarfs, you know, it's more than 10 times the amount of extra going on defence, which at the time of war in Ukraine, you think is pretty significant. But as you'd expect, the municipalities and regions and the Social Democrats and the Left Party are all saying it's not nearly enough.
Yeah.
But so I'd say those are the big headlines.
Okay. And aside from those, Emma, what parts of the budget are going to have the biggest impact on most people's everyday lives, would you say?
Well, I mean, Richard briefly mentioned the working tax credit, that the pausing of the threshold for raising the state tax is supposed to kind of fund. So this working tax credit, it's not entirely clear yet exactly how it's going to be used, but it's mainly going to benefit those earning around 38,000 kronor a month or less. Mm-hmm. And the example that was used when they presented it was that a family consisting of a police officer and a nurse would pay 14,000 kronor less in tax. I mean, I guess if another thing that might impact your life is if you happen to use tobacco, you may be interested in knowing that they're lowering the tax on snus, which is Sweden's famous moist tobacco that you stick under your upper lip. Yep. And they're raising the tax on cigarettes. Because I think they say that snus is generally better for your health than cigarettes. Mm. Although I guess even better would be to not consume any tobacco at all. But there you go. And those are some of the things that you might immediately notice. But there are other things that will have a kind of indirect effect. Like, for example, something that might affect a lot of listeners is that they're investing 140 million kronor in boosting the quality of Swedish for immigrants teaching, although it's not entirely clear how. And actually, 140 million doesn't sound like that much to me in context, but I'm not sure how it's going to work yet. They also want to completely scrap funding for ethnic organizations in order to improve integration, which is interesting because I remember we actually had a researcher on the podcast a while ago who said that actually groups that are based around ethnicity or nationality or things like that, they are actually good for integration because they provide a kind of pathway into Swedish society.
Exactly, that's right. That was Andrea Voyer from Stockholm University, who we had on at the end of August last year, if anyone wants to go back and listen to that episode. She had a lot of really interesting things to say in general about segregation. Okay, thanks very much for those updates on the budget. We'll link to an article in the show notes on how it's likely to affect us all.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Okay, let's talk about gang crime now. Not for the first time on this podcast, unfortunately, and certainly not the last. So Sweden's gang conflict has kicked off again in an extremely violent way in recent weeks, with a spate of attacks and deadly shootings concentrated mostly in the Stockholm and Uppsala areas. Katrin, as you mentioned at the beginning, you've been covering crime in Sweden for the best part of two decades as a reporter for the Expressen newspaper. Can you put the gang crime situation in some sort of perspective for us? How bad is it compared to what's come before?
It is very bad and very violent. Mm. And compared to what we've seen before, we see innocent people like relatives that are directly targeted. And we also see people who get shot and killed by mistake. Mm. We see a lot of very young, stressed out people committing these crimes. And the violence we see is very aggressive.
Yeah. And a lot of the violence in recent weeks has taken place in Uppsala, which is where the suspected leader of the so-called Foxtrot gang, Rawa Majid, grew up. Can you tell us a little bit about him? Who is Rawa Majid, who's often referred to in the Swedish media as the Kurdish Fox? And why are there so many attacks in his hometown now, despite the fact that he's believed to be living in Turkey?
Yeah, so it's a proxy war that we see right now. Mm. The leadership in the Foxtrot gang, Rawa Majid, and his former ally, Ismail Abdo, are both detained by Swedish prosecutors many times over for serious crimes, but they have moved to Turkey. Mm. And something has made them turn against each other. And we know that there have been several attempted attacks in Turkey, but everything just seems to have imploded there. And when Ismail Abdo's mother was murdered in Uppsala, it turned into this spiral of violence that is now playing out. And we see in cities such as Uppsala, but also Norrköping and Stockholm. It's just everywhere where people who are connected to these people live. And Rawa Majid, he is a large-scale drug trafficker, and he's suspected of smuggling and distributing countless kilos of drugs all over Sweden.
Mm. So just to clarify that, Ismail Abdo's mother, she was one of the victims in these recent shootings, right? Just in the,
yes,
in the last
she was.
Weeks.
And I would say that that maybe was the start of this very, very violent period that we have seen. But it was the conflict had been brewing sort of in Turkey between these people. And then there was this killing, and she had absolutely nothing to do with anything except being a relative and a mother to Ismail Abdo.
So that's happening a lot more now, is it, that relatives of these gang leaders are being drawn into the conflict?
Yes, we've seen several cases of this. And this is also an effect of this proxy war that we see. They just get at anyone who is connected and maybe not close.
Yeah. So I read something in the newspaper this morning, just before we came in, to report that Majid is sort of fighting a war on three fronts at the moment. So he has this internal conflict with Ismail Abdo that you've just talked about, but also two of the other networks, the Dalen network, which is based in the south of Stockholm, and the Bandidos, the old sort of motorcycle gang. Is that a fair reflection, do you think?
Yes, it is. The conflict with Dalen is... And that was behind the first, that we call the first wave of violence that we saw maybe from January and until the summer.
Yeah.
And we also saw some attacks on the Bandidos that we think are connected. So yes, I would say that that's a fair description. Yeah.
And it's interesting that we're talking about Rawa Majid and using his real name. Like, Swedish media are generally reluctant to publish the names of suspected criminals until very late in the legal process. But Expressen's deputy editor, Karin Olsson, wrote an article this week explaining why your newspaper took an early decision to publish his name. Can you talk us through the rationale behind that decision?
Yes, it has to do with the nature of organized crime today. I mean, how it operates and how to explain what is going on to our readers and listeners. These people are drug lords,
yeah.
Drug barons, if you will. They operate on a large scale, and what they do has a serious impact on our society. They have a lot of informal power and yeah. also a lot of inherent violence. And I would say traditionally, many media outlets, they would follow the judicial process and they would wait for a conviction of so and so many years before naming a criminal. But yeah. the gangs operate internationally and the leadership is in the background. So if we wait for them to get captured and convicted, we could wait forever. And it would be very hard for our audience to know what is happening.
Mm.
So we feel that we have to call these people out. And we also have to focus, of course, on the victims of yeah. of gang violence, which is something we do a lot also.
Can I just say that this is always a big issue for me when I've been working for British newspapers, because especially when the crimes become so international, that when you've got, you know, there was this person murdered in Battersea and a big trial in Battersea of gangsters who are based in Sweden, and when they feature a lot. I mean, the English media is naming all of them because they're on trial. I mean, do you then not name them in your report from Sweden, or should you? I mean, they're all over their names are all over the international press. Can Sweden still not name them when all it takes is a Google search for someone to find it in an article written from Turkey or England? I mean, I think it's like crimes become so international that it's that naming convention's harder to stick to.
But every newspaper makes their own kind of decision. I mean, it happens mm-hmm. even within Sweden that some newspapers will name mm-hmm. a suspected criminal or a convicted yeah, yes. criminal, and some newspapers don't.
No, absolutely. No, it's true.
You referred to Majid as a drug lord, and so much of the conflict centers around drugs. How big is the drug trade in Sweden? How important is it to understanding this conflict?
I would say that drug trafficking is at the core of all of this, and it's extremely lucrative
yeah.
business, and it has increasingly become so. And it's also, I would say, you find drugs at every corner of the city and every city in Sweden, and it's just a very, very huge business, and it's to be on top of it and to control it is very, very lucrative.
And how much has Sweden become a hub in the European drug trade? I mean, there were a lot of reports earlier in the year about how a lot of cocaine was being smuggled on banana boats from Ecuador to Helsingborg in Skåne primarily. So how important is somewhere like Helsingborg as a hub in the European drug trade now?
It is very important. They have made, like you said, some very large seizures. But you also see, I mean, you see drugs coming in from everywhere. They come to Göteborg, which is yeah. also a big harbor. They come through the bridge, of course, from Denmark. So it's yeah. just it's flooding in from so many ways. And it's just ongoing. And I think the customs have also made it some large seizures. But still, it's just an ongoing... It just comes in new loads every day.
Mm.
So
yeah,
it's hard to track everything.
Why is there such a big market for drugs in Sweden?
Well, that's a good question, actually. It's just people use a lot of drugs. I mean, you can just, it's easy to buy. You don't have to, the way it works now, you don't really have to get in contact with anyone who is shady or sketchy. I mean, it's just, you can buy it online. It's just very easy. To get access to drugs is very easy. I mean, and obviously it's the market for it is very big.
So last week, a 13-year-old boy was found murdered in a wooded area in Haninge, south of Stockholm, in a suspected gang shooting. Are you seeing, Katrine, in your reporting that the age profile of gang members has changed and become younger in recent times?
Absolutely. This is a trend that we have seen for a while. But now it is more than common with 13, 14, 15-year-old criminals
yeah.
and victims, of course. And we call them child soldiers. And it's not really correct, of course, but we can see that children are being used in a very cynical way by gangs such as the Foxtrot yeah. and other gangs too. And I think you have to understand, first of all, to use children to commit serious crimes is rational in a way, because even if they lack, you know, skill yeah. and things can go wrong, as they often do, if they get caught and they're under 15, they will get sent to juvenile institution.
Yeah.
So you can actually shoot someone in the head and you can be out on the street in a couple of years. And the instigators, they're often really hard to pin down. Mm. So they don't really risk that much. And some kids are being coerced, but because of this whole gang culture and the allure surrounding it, many also line up to get in. And most gangs, they have rappers connected to them that they work as ambassadors in a way. Mm. And once in the gang, you might find that you're in over your head, but it's really hard to back down. And we do see that these children are, they're just completely expendable. They are, cannon fodder, what it was called. And in fact, there is a completely new crime that is supposed to combat this. And as of July this year, it's called involving a minor in criminal activity. This crime involves everything from, asking someone to be on the lookout to giving someone money or instructions to do something. And the maximum penalty is 4 years. Right. I don't think we've seen that, but there are a few sentences already. And we will certainly see more of this.
Interesting. Richard, Emma, can I bring you back in now? So if we look at Swedish politics, the right-wing government won the election last year on a promise to get tough on crime and push back against the gangsters. Is it too early to judge them on this, Richard?
I'd say yes and no. I mean, to an extent, if you're someone who, doesn't believe that tough on crime works, you could judge them as soon as they started offering, these populist solutions, which, most of the researchers on crime reduction would tell them won't work, like stop and search zones and stuff like that. But Ulf Kristersson, the Prime Minister, he did repeatedly say in the election campaign that it would take a long time to solve Sweden's problems with gang violence. So it's unlike a lot of the promises they made in the election. This one, they were quite careful just to say, we're not going to solve this straight away. And and he said, it will take more than one term in government even. And also, very few of the new laws that they're trying to enact that have come into force yet. And a lot of their response to gang crime is legal. It's about tightening the law. So I think we should wait until the laws come into effect before we can say that they have or haven't worked. I mean, one thing I can say, this is just an additional thing, is I don't feel, I was just thinking about the answer to this question. I haven't seen Gunnar Strömmer, the Justice Minister, or Ulf Kristersson, the Prime Minister, kind of out on the streets, meeting policemen, going to the suburbs, talking to parents of people affected, meeting police officers, or doing any things like that. I think, just thinking about it now, I think they're a bit distant. I mean, Strömmer is very concerned with laws and framing laws, and he's a top lawyer. And I don't feel that he's kind of on the ground with his sleeves rolled up, making us at least giving a signal that I'm getting to grips with this. And the same goes for Ulf Kristersson. He seems quite distant. He prefers international diplomacy and stuff like that. So I don't think there's a figure in the government who is kind of out there working with police, kind of giving the signal that we're doing something about this. But I might be wrong. I mean, it feels that way to me.
Yeah, that's interesting. I haven't thought about it. But when you say it, I saw Kristersson, he was out in Farsta when this innocent man was from Eritrea was shot. Then I saw him there. But other than that, no, they're not really digging into this on a street level, I think. No.
What do you think, Emma?
Kristersson now says that it will take a long time to solve, but he definitely wasn't shy to criticize the previous government when shooting rates started going up. But, I mean, Richard mentioned this sort of tough on crime posturing, but it's kind of tricky also because these things are happening now, so they need to be cracked down on now. Like, a lot of these sort of hardened criminals running these things, like, they don't need a hug, they need to be locked up for a very long time, But at the same time, like, preventive measures, that's what's going to determine what the situation is like 20 years from now. Like, investing in schools and social services and the kind of soft police measures, like how police officers go out and interact with people on the street and stuff like that. But, I mean, 20 years is, that's five election cycles. So it's not going to win you the next election. Like, you might get credit for something 20 years from now, but it's not going to help you as a politician right now.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Katrine, before we finish up, can I just ask you how you think the gang violence situation is likely to develop in the months ahead?
Like I said, it's a bit of a capture or kill situation that we see right now. like either the authorities, in this case that would be Swedish and Turkish, decide to act together and crack down on the Foxtrot organization, or the two factions of the Foxtrot gang will continue to fight each other until Rawa Majid or Ismail Abdo are dead.
Yeah.
Or at least someone in the leadership, because you know, to kill someone's mother, it's a declaration of war and it has to be retaliated. And I think that society is mobilizing, but I don't think we can see the end of this violence just yet.
That's it for this week. Thanks to all our listeners for tuning in. Our panelists this week were The Local's Emma Lovegrain and Richard Orange, and Expressen's crime reporter Catherine Krantz. Our sound engineer is Rhys Edwards. I'm Paul O'Mahony, and we'll be back again next week with another episode of Sweden in Focus. Until then, take care.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
That's all for this week's free edition of Sweden in Focus. If you'd like to hear a full-length version of the podcast each week, as well as an additional midweek episode with more interviews and analysis, please upgrade to Membership Plus. Make sure to check the episode notes for details on how to upgrade. Sweden in Focus is a podcast by The Local Europe. Our sound engineer is Rhys Edwards. The publisher is James Savage.